Hello and welcome to episode 32 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav. With me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Tanner, also known as Ben304, and we have two special guests today.
Yes.
Dave Gilbert, also known as Dave Gilbert.
And Jenny Gilbert, also known as Dave's wife.
Dave enjoyed his time on our podcast so much that he wanted to come back, so... We're gladly have you back, and Janet this time.
Instead of doing the usual thing where you wait like 2 months and go, all right, let's get him back. We're like, let's bring him back straight away.
Yeah,
I'm here. So yeah, well, I'm glad because it was kind of very energizing talking about the stuff last week, and it's no coincidence. I had a really good week work wise. I got a lot done.
Good.
So this worked out well. I enjoyed it.
Good.
Good.
Right. So. Let's jump into this. We got a request from Brian Demodulated on Twitter, and he says, topic request, alpha/beta testing, modifying your game based on player feedback, and your reaction to post-release comments. So this is a fun topic to discuss.
It's kind of two topics, really.
Well...
But, yeah.
Yes.
Pre-release and post-release feedback are pretty different. I would say... When you're talking about like beta testing and alpha testing, there's really two different types of testing that you look for. There's bug finding, which is pretty just generic, you know, this looks wrong, that looks wrong, this has the wrong thing there. And then there's actual play testing where you're looking for, does this work as a game? Does it work as a story? Does it do the right stuff? So it's very... I know particularly you, Dave, you really specify when you're getting people to play the game, you know, I want you to not just focus on what looks wrong and what plays wrong, but... Also, does it feel right as a game? Does it feel right as a story? Do you think it's more... I think it's more important, personally, to focus on that stuff first, because if the design doesn't work, but you get all the bugs fixed, when you change the design, you're going to get more bugs anyway. So, you know, do you find yourself focusing on that first?
Well, for something like Blackwell, where everything is, like, crappy placeholder art anyway... Yeah, I know there are going to be bugs, and if you report a bug, it almost isn't worth fixing it, because I know I'm just going to be creating even more bugs once I get the final art in, i.e. your art, Ben. So yeah, I prefer to focus on the story stuff. Just does it work? Does it make sense? Do you understand it? It's important, not just because like I'm not confident of my ideas, but sometimes they just notice things that I don't, or things just things that make sense to me don't make sense to other people, that kind of thing. There's actually a moment in Blackwell Epiphany where a character is someone else's father, and you're going to that person's office looking for information, but for some reason a lot of the testers didn't know why they were in that office looking for information. And I'm like, you didn't realize that this was this person's father and that's why you're there? And they're like, no, I didn't realize that. So I had to make that clearer, that kind of thing. So that definitely, that's why I like to test as early as possible, just to kind of get that feedback.
I feel the same way, but I have this thing, it's a personal neurosis where... When I have my placeholder art, I like to get my rooms done as quickly as possible, because I always figure that for some reason they're going to change drastically, even though they don't necessarily. So I always feel like I'm going to have to redraw all my hotspots and everything, which I very rarely do. So it's counterproductive for me personally, because getting the art done is not necessarily top priority. I've been focusing a lot more on getting a fully playable skeleton of a game out first, because, yeah, it lets you get it tested.
Definitely.
Sure. I know when you were working with PlayFirst on stuff like Emerald City Confidential, you had an actual thing where you'd watch video feeds of players play your game. One thing I've noticed is it's probably the most awkward, frustrating thing in the entire world to watch someone else play your game. Have you noticed that?
Watching someone else play your adventure game is also really frustrating. I think just because you know how it's supposed to be solved, and watching someone like come so close but not quite is just very frustrating, because adventure games, you can't rush it. They'll solve the puzzles at their own pace, and it's very, very frustrating to watch, especially with the play first thing with Emerald City Confidential was interesting, because they got testers in who never played an adventure game before. So naturally, they had no clue. And the example I always like to give, I think you might have mentioned this on the podcast before, actually, is how when they picked up a crowbar and there's a locked door. So the obvious thing to do would be to use that crowbar on the door. But instead, they kept clicking the crowbar on the main character. And when they were finally, like after like 10 minutes of them like just not knowing, not figuring out what to do with that crowbar, seriously, it took like 10, 20 minutes for some of these people to get through this point. The test givers, the people giving the test, just broke down and said, "Why are you clicking the crowbar on Petra?" And they're like, "I'm trying to give her the crowbar. Why isn't she taking the crowbar?" And it makes perfect sense. I mean, there's no reason to think otherwise. It's just we've been trained to play these games in a specific way, and so we just instinctively know what to do. But put that in front of someone who's never played an adventure game before or a point-and-click adventure game before, and they're completely lost. So a lot of people complained that Emerald City Confidential was so hand-holdy, and that's the reason, is because that's the audience they wanted to market this game to. So sadly, we had to make a lot of concessions for them.
But, you know, I don't... I guess... I understand also kind of what the logic behind them wanting to give her the crowbar is, because I guess... I don't know, but it doesn't really make sense to me either, because what other games do you play where you're interacting with the character? I mean, most other games, you are the character. You have an avatar on the screen that you're controlling. Why would they think that in an adventure game you'd have to give a crowbar to someone on the screen?
Well, in time management sort of games.
Yeah,
in time management games, that's what you do. You give the person a thing, and then they go and do the thing with it. So if they're used to playing casual games, that's what they're going to do.
I guess.
Have you found the same thing with iOS, Janet? Like, with people that have never played the games, do the same stuff?
Well, beta testing for Wadgetire, I don't really deal with people who've never played an adventure game before. Everyone who beta tests for us is basically a fan of our stuff already. So... I don't need to deal with that.
And typically, no one would buy one of our games if they weren't already, at least on iOS, they wouldn't. It's not really the kind of game that an Angry Birds player would be interested in.
Fair enough.
So
Candy Crush, Black Widow.
Yeah.
That's one of the benefits of making them reassuringly expensive. People only buy them if they're really, really sure they want to play an adventure game. So we get
that's some a good movies. Point. Yeah.
That's what I never would have thought as $4.99 as being reassuringly expensive.
Yeah.
What a high price point. Good lord, ridiculous.
My pocket. Actually,
that's a debate Jen and I had recently, going a little off topic, but whether if we ever, for our older games, it makes sense, but for a new game where it's on the PC, I charge $9.99, why is it suddenly worth less on iOS?
Because
normally, you would think, charge $9.99 on iOS? But for a brand new game, I'm like, well, it takes a lot more effort to make the iOS version. Why is it suddenly worth less money? especially considering that... I don't know. It's just a weird thought I had.
It's
like,
a lot
what,
smaller.
What makes it worth less?
I don't know.
The way it is, remember when PC games were $20 each?
I do.
Sweet.
Sigh.
Wasn't there a big to-do recently?
A wind of change is blowing.
Wasn't there a big to-do recently about some game on iOS that was like $29.99 and everyone was like, oh my god, that's unheard of. That's insane. But it was a brand new game and it was something fancy. I don't remember what it was exactly. But
I don't know.
I don't know which game. I heard something about it, but I don't remember which game it was. Hmm. But yeah, man, I remember buying brand new games, especially here in Australia, for like $80, $90.
Yeah, I remember.
Didn't pick anything up.
I remember buying King's Quest VI for $49.99 at Electronics Boutique.
Yeah, what an old man!
Shut up, Sonny.
moving back onto feedback. Have you ever had a point where you've had testers divided? Because I know I've had testers in the past really divided, like two different parties really, really saying, oh, this doesn't work at all for me, and then the other side going, oh, man, this is perfect, don't change this. Does anybody know of a way of solving this issue, or do you just go with, gut instinct, or has no one else had this before?
I have, and I can tell, but Dave can go first.
You go first, since you got a story lined up.
Okay, well, more recently, with A Golden Wake, the very first iteration of the game that I sent out, there's a puzzle pretty early on that was originally a mandatory puzzle, which was a logic puzzle, which Ben, you had no trouble with, and Dave, when you played it, you were like, yeah, I can see it, but it's just not really fun. So, you know, a couple of other people liked it, a couple of other people thought it was tedious. So the solution I had with that was to do the old Vince 12 and make it optional and have two puzzles in the same, one slightly easier, one a little bit more for hardcore puzzle solvers.
You showed me what which is that you one. Did, and it's yeah. awesome. It's awesome what you did to get around all that. Yeah. I was very impressed.
Good, I'm glad. So actually, I
won't give it away.
I got inspired by that, and I actually made multiple solutions to several puzzles of that ilk throughout the rest of the game. So yeah, so I think definitely if you find yourself divided, it's probably a good idea to look for alternate solutions. And because you never want, especially early on in the game, you never want your players to get stuck or frustrated or quit or whatever, or throw the game out the window, as it were. So yeah, it's probably a good idea to look for alternate methods. And who knows, maybe you come up with something amazing.
Well, that's actually something I wish I had realized several years ago when, back when I think Unbound came out, a lot of the feedback for the notebook interface, where you combine clues to get other clues, a lot of the critiques of it, no one really seemed to like it. I don't know, a lot of people got really stuck on any puzzle involving the notebook. They just, no one seemed to like it. And so my first instinct was, well, this just doesn't work. It's not fun. So I just got rid of it. And then, of course, Conversions came out, and then everyone was like, how come you can't combine clues anymore? Like, we miss it. And I realized that it wasn't the feedback I was getting. I was misinterpreting the feedback. It wasn't, we hate this. It wasn't, we don't like this, therefore it sucks. It was more like, they liked the idea, it just wasn't implemented well. So for Deception, I kind of started futzing with the interface and trying to come up with a better way that it could be used. The problem with it was that if there was two clues that could obviously be connected, the player would make that connection in their head, but they didn't feel the need to like make the connection within the game because it's something that they did already. So that intuitive leap just wasn't there. Yeah. So I made it so the clues you combine are things you can't do on your own in your head. It's only something that the interface can do for you. So that's how I figured it out.
Yeah, I really like
that's a good example.
I really like the new layer that you introduced to it by having Rosa have a smartphone where you have to sometimes do searches for things in order to be able to piece clues together. I think that's a lot more involved and a lot more, well, modern, really, than just...
Well, it was annoying to have to run back to her apartment every time I wanted to use the computer. I gave her smartphone. I'm like, all right. Of course, the only problem with that, the reason why I didn't give her the smartphone before was because I kind of established that Joey kind of screws up wireless signals.
Right.
But I'm like, you know, whatever. It needs to be there. So I'm like, she's got a really good phone. It works.
I can't wait. If you ever port it to iOS, you're going to have a person using a smartphone within a smartphone. It's very meta. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, in Gemini Rue, you kind of already have that.
Yeah, there's a point. So there you go. You're bringing the meta to the people. Yes. All right, I have a question. What do you look for in a tester? Because you've probably had the most testers of any AGS person ever. What do you look for in a tester?
Various things. I mean, the thing is, I never really know how good the tester is or what kind of tester they are until they start testing. I liked getting a variety. I mean, you get the two different kinds. You get the really detail oriented. We'll find like every misplaced comma and period, every little obscure bug, but they won't notice that like the character walks backwards. You know, they won't notice the big things. Rather, you get like the casual players who'll notice the big things, like how, you know, a character just seems to be invisible for some reason, or, you know, like the bigger, more obvious things, because they're playing more casually, it tends to be how an average person would play the game, and that's also important. So it's good to get the detail stuff fixed as well as the more casual stuff fixed. So it really depends. I mean, if someone just gives one really good report and then doesn't play it again, that's fine because we got something good out of it, versus like someone who like plays every build obsessively and reports every little thing. That's also important, but the obsessive details are the polish, while the more casual details are, I guess, are the core of it. So they're both, I don't know if this makes sense, but they're both important. So it's hard to say, it's always hard to tell what kind of tester a person is until they actually start testing, or if they test at all.
Yeah, some people, sorry.
For iOS is a particular thing I want, because Apple has this really ridiculous rule, which means that I can't have all that many beta testers. You can have only 100 devices registered to your account for testing per year for all your games. So what I value in a beta tester is being willing to test more than one game and being willing to test more than one build.
Yeah, the problem there is that, like, yeah, we could totally test and we give them access and they don't test, which means we lose that spot and we can't give it to someone else. So, yeah, you know, people listening, if you want to test our iOS builds, then you really need to actually test it.
Sorry.
So if someone just posts one really excellent bug report for an iOS game, it's a problem because that's one report for the entire year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So yes, I had to give everyone, before the beta test for Shiver, I gave everyone a really hard time saying you will test more than one game, you will test more than one beta, and
we gave him a guilt trip.
Yes, I think most fair people enough. Kind of figured that out on the test.
Well, I guess it's
I didn't get very many testers at all because most people were not willing to commit to that.
It's a commitment.
I guess, yeah. For the Shiva, it's perfectly appropriate to give him a guilt trip. You could have brought in an old Jewish granny and been like, why don't you play my game?
Don't you like it?
Don't you? I made it just for you and you don't play it. Yes. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about comments and feedback after release. Because actually, Ben and I were having a little conversation about this recently where we were talking about Google Alerts and how you can sometimes set Google Alerts to see when people talk about your game, for good or for bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I use that. I mean, it's like I've kind of, after how long has it been? 8 years, Jesus.
Yeah.
I just sort of, I don't follow that stuff as closely as I used to when I first started, like, for the first couple of years, yeah, I'd read every comment obsessively. But now I just have to, it just drives me crazy. If I read something good about the game, yeah, I feel kind of good. But if I read something bad, I feel absolutely horrible. So I sort of exert some control and just leave. Like, all right, I'm going out for lunch, or I'm just like going to play on the console or just read or something. Stay away from the computer. Stay away from the internet. Stay away from Google Alerts for a while.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you can drive yourself absolutely mad. Just tracking stats and sales details and everything. And you gotta also, I think Jeff Vogel once said, and when he was asked the same question, is that you gotta limit the voices in your head. That makes any sense.
Yeah,
and just, otherwise, you could just, it's the only way you can keep your sanity, at least for me, because, you know, it's sort of our life. So when you're reading comments nonstop, it's like they're commenting about your actual life.
Oh, sure.
And it's really hard.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's
very easy to let, like, the one negative comment, surpass in priority all of, like, you might get 100 good comments and one negative comment, and you don't care about that one, all the other good comments, because that one bad comment kind of comes to the fore and you're like, oh man, I could have done this better, I could have done that.
And I mean, the worst thing about
that,
it's usually something that you're kind of aware of as well. Like, yeah, no, there's nothing I could do about that. It was not enough time or whatever. Or it's just like, yeah, you sort of, it hits home because you agree. But due to some reason or another, you just didn't do it.
There's always going to be compromises you have to make, I think. Is there a point, like, when you look at a thing and you go, you know what, this is too hard, I'm going to cut this. This is, too many people aren't getting it. Is there a point when you realize that, or do you just, I don't know, play it by feel?
All the time.
Yeah.
the time.
Because I think there's things you just can't make it work no matter what you try, and you have to cut your losses and, you know, trim the fat from the game and move on.
Yeah. Well, don't you remember the commissioner scene?
I do remember the commissioner scene.
This is something. This isn't a spoiler because it was a scene that was cut from Blackwell Epiphany. There was Ben animated a whole character. There was a background and portraits made for this scene in Blackwell Epiphany that, when I wrote it, it seemed fine, but then I put it into the game and it just didn't seem to work. There was just something I just did not like about it. And it's Rosa meets the city commissioner and they have this conversation, and I just didn't like it. And it drove me crazy. I'm like, what? Something about this just does not work. And I put it in front of the testers. I'm like, all right, guys, I know this sucks. Tell me what are your thoughts? What are your feelings about it? I want to see if I can make this work. And some people liked it, some people didn't. And in the end, I'm just like, you know what? I just don't like this at all. I don't like it. I just don't like it. And I just got rid of it. It just didn't work. It completely changed the tone of the game, the tone of the series. It just didn't fit. And weirdly enough, I felt very justified. Francisco, you'll like this, because the latest season of Dexter had a character that was exactly like that character, man, that I cut. And she was awful. No one liked her. So I'm like, all right, I guess I even had the same accent, too. So I'm like, all right, I guess I made a good choice.
Wait, which character?
Vogel.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, sort of, not that it wasn't that it was a psychiatrist, right, but it was sort of like some character comes in out of nowhere and is like, hey, so I know what's been going on this whole time.
Yeah.
Guess what? You've never seen me before.
Yeah. I didn't mind Vogel. I just, she was pretty useless.
Okay.
Anyway.
I didn't mind Vogel so much.
No, I didn't. I wasn't one of the... I mean, she was okay. I mean, it was a bit silly. I thought, that they brought her in kind of out of nowhere, but I don't know. It's just... It's a bit ham-fisted. I have a bit in A Golden Wake also that I feel kind of on the fence about, and I'm probably ultimately going to have to either change it or cut it or something, because it just, I don't know, there's something about it. But I'm really hesitant too, because there's a background that I drew that took me ages, and Ben will remember this. It's a background with a couple of royal Ponciana trees in it, and they're very special trees because they took me forever to get looking right. And I literally spent about 10 hours on this stupid background with these stupid trees, and if I have to cut it, I'll be very sad, but I guess you gotta live and learn. If it doesn't work anyway.
Did you start drawing that in a cafe?
No, not that particular one.
No, you were still in Miami when you drew that.
It's those different background with trees.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. I've drawn a lot of backgrounds with trees.
I think sometimes when you go looking for feedback like that, you're not looking for new opinions so much as you are why something doesn't work, or you know something's bad, but you don't know why it's bad, or you can't really figure out why. I think sometimes that's a really important thing for people, not to just say, I don't like this, it doesn't work, but to justify, it doesn't work because... Why. Yeah, I think that's a really important... It's this new set of eyes, a new perspective on something. And if they go, this doesn't work because, this connection never gets made, or, this is too convenient, then you go, of course, and make a change there or cut it completely, of course.
That's sort of my attitude towards everything, where it's like... I even say this about art. It's like, all right, there's something about this I don't like, but I can't figure out what it is. So I sometimes send it to other people and I'm like, what's wrong with this? Tell me what's wrong with this. I know something's wrong. Like, something's up with the eyes. So like, you're right. Something is up with the eyes.
You did it to me with, you sent me the picture, for the portrait for Rosa for Deception, the redone one. And...
Yeah, there was some of the expressions were, something just looked weird. And
her jaw was like off by like one pixel, but one pixel makes all the difference sometimes.
Yeah. Awkward, Paul.
This podcast is all about awkward pauses.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too much because I've been asking all the questions. So I thought I better let Francisco have a turn.
Okay. Well, I was completely mind blanking right now. So let's see. Ben, I have a question for you. How do you feel about comments, and what's your experience been with reading stuff about your games? You seem like the type of person that wouldn't really care too much.
Yeah, I'll say this, you know, on the internet, if you go and you look in Steam forums and if you look on YouTube comments and stuff like that, people say really stupid stuff without thinking about what they're saying. And a lot of the times if you get negative comments...
Have you seen the Steam forum for the Shiver?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, you know.
You got to wade in there with like rubber boots. It's just vile.
It's really easy, particularly, you know, if it's one of your earlier games, you know, and you haven't done much yet, and every little bit of feedback really, really counts to you, and someone comes in there and just, like, you know, just starts throwing all these stupid, you know, just insults and being offensive. A lot of the time, it's really not about your game, it's about the people playing it. So, you know, while feedback's really important, but it's also really important to remember that on the internet, the target audience for your product is really huge, and it's really impersonal. It's really easy to say, oh, you know, this is the worst game I've ever played, this is stupid. And, you know, I was telling Francisco the other day, with one of my games I got accused of trying to start a cult. You know, people just say things. I thought it was hilarious, but, you know, at the time I was like, oh man, this is awful, you know, I feel horrible
which
about
game
this.
But was a cult starting game.
I never managed to start my cult, unfortunately. But yeah, you know, people
just
say.
The cult of Ben.
The cult of the 304.
Yeah, but people will just say things for the sake of saying it. So, you know, while feedback's important to go, oh, you know, someone will say, oh, I didn't like the puzzles because, you know, they were too generic, or they felt like this, or this wasn't well hinted at. And you go, oh, that's valuable constructive feedback. A lot of the time, people aren't constructive with their feedback. They're actually quite destructive, and it's important to recognize the difference there, you know. And I know, especially on the AGS forums, we have this thing where if people criticize a game, we generally try to get them to be constructive. And, you know, if people are just being unfriendly, the moderators will usually point out, you know, if you're going to give feedback, make sure it's constructive. But, yeah, that's something really important to keep in mind. People will try and hurt your feelings for no good reason other than they've got nothing better to do. So yeah, very, very important.
I'm glad that the community has kind of lightened up with commercial games. I know the first couple of commercials were not treated really well. I know Himalaya was treated really horribly when that game came out. Even made for like the equivalent of the Raspberry Award. Can we say the word on this?
Said a lot worse. Yeah, there used to be the penis award for the age. Yeah. The P3N1S award, which, yeah, it was. Yeah. But that was, yeah, that was just people being assholes. I mean, I mean, that was, yeah, it was the equivalent of the Razzie, the worst game, and Alamo and The Lost Dutchman's Mind got nominated just because I think, yeah, people were, I don't know if it was spiteful or resentful or what the problem was, but, yeah, I think a lot of people didn't like the main character's voice and just the production values and all that stuff, but you have to give Himalaya props for doing what they did. I mean,
yeah, they were one of the trailblazers. And Fat Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I think it's easy. People get a sense of entitlement when you've been around free games, you know, you've had these amazing quality free games, and then people go, I want to get paid for this now. People get a sense of entitlement where they go, oh, well, everyone else is making games for free. Why shouldn't you? Yeah. Which is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous notion, you know?
I always wonder, people have often asked me if I would consider putting together all the Ben Jordan games in like a pack and sell it. And I always say, why would you buy games that you can download for free? And I wonder if I were to actually do that, how many people would actually buy them, and how many people would be like, oh, well, why should we download them, buy them when we can download them for free, you know? How many people would actually
put their
money where their
mouth is? I think you'd be surprised, honestly. I think if you did something special with it, like added extra commentary, or I know there's commentary already on them, but
Put it on Steam.
That's what everybody tells me, but Steam doesn't take
free. I don't know how much I agree with it. It's called The Curve, and it's all about this phenomenon of free. Right. And it's more like these days people will pay, like if you let people pay what they feel something is worth, you'll be really surprised what people are willing to pay. I'm not sure how much of that I buy into, but that sort of ties into the whole Kickstarter thing. Like, if
well, I've had a donate button on my website for years, and I get random people donating every once in a while. Not so much anymore, but I got some pretty surprisingly generous donations a couple of times that I was taken aback by.
Mm.
So,
yeah, I know Vince was really surprised when some people actually gave him like, you know, $100,000 for on that old Resonance Kickstarter from way back when. He only got $2,000 from it total, but someone was willing to put in $500. Was quite surprising, and they, you know, got their character, they got themselves in the game. What was funny is that this is before we published it, but for $500 you got an executive producer credit. And so in the credits, sure enough, she's got the executive producer credit.
That's awesome.
she's above my name.
That's nice. Yes.
But you know, you have to do it. So
you heard it here first. Money buys power. With Vince 12. The funny thing with that is that the Kickstarter was only to cover the IGF fee. You know, it's it's like, yeah, Kickstarter wasn't really a thing for games back then. But one thing that I've noticed with Kickstarter is you've got people pledging to games, and they get a sort of sense of entitlement. And you know, while the game's being made, it really worries me that people will try and change the games. You know, not just in the form of a beta test, but you know, I've invested in this game. Listen to me. You know, my voice is more important now. Yeah. It really worries me.
That is definitely. I know that happens quite a bit, and I know that there's. You do have to kind of really. It's something I really should follow a lot more closely, because it's something that we might do in the future, just how to work with that kind of community. And I have seen that where you really do have to be upfront about why you do things, why you don't do things. At the end of the day, you have to say, you know, you put your faith in us, continue to trust us, that kind of thing. But then again, you ask for feedback and they will give it to you. They're a lot more willing to you know, be involved because they have an investment in it. So that's also something.
Yeah,
actually, go ahead, Ben, because I was going to segue. I was going to bring out the magical segue machine.
Okay. That's a thing I think you really need to consider is if people are testing your game, they're testing your game because they like testing games a lot of the time. Whereas if people are funding your game on Kickstarter, they're going to be a fan of what you're doing and they're going to be really invested in the idea. So I hate to bring up Jeff Vogel again because we've brought him up quite a bit lately, but I noticed he, in an interview recently, talked about how important it is to refine how many voices you listen to and just have a select core of opinions that you really trust and go with those. Not just, you know, Harry from the internet says, oh, I think your game should be like this. I think that's really important. He makes a good point there.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue with the segue.
No, I think, like I said before, I quoted him, you limit the voices in your head.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So my segue is talking about Kickstarter and how one of the stretch goals, or the tiers, I should say, is usually that, like, you can get your name in the credits or sometimes even be a character in the game. I know, Dave, you've done this before with, like, fan art contests where you have people, fans, be characters in the game. I personally think, like, in Broken Sword 5 is one of the Kickstarter games that I've actually played. They had a character who was obviously a fan, and it was like, it was, you know, it was cute how they handled it and whatever. But sometimes games handle things like that in kind of a silly way. I mean, if you have a certain game where the tone doesn't quite fit with breaking the fourth wall and stuff like that, it can be a little strange. So, like, what do you think is a good limit for? Because I also bring this up, you were talking about how you had played Heroine's Quest and how there's a lot of Easter eggs with, like, Sierra characters and things like that. What do you think is a good limit for doing that sort of thing in games?
I think I played Shadowrun Returns, and they had a lot of that, where backers got their faces in the game as characters, and I didn't even notice. But the people who paid money did notice. I remember on Twitter, someone's like, oh my God, I found my character, and posted the screenshot of his character. And I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that guy. you know, they just, and he was just a guy in the game, and it was just, you know, he was given like, you know, a, you know, elf ears and a punk haircut, and but it looked like the guy, and that was totally fine. I didn't even notice or even think that, oh, this is obviously a Kickstarter backer. It was just one portrait out of many, and that seemed fine because it made the backers happy, and people, you know, folks like me who just play the game were totally happy with it. Didn't even notice. I know that something like adventure games where I guess if there's characters that are just so obviously there, like I didn't play the game, but I've seen screenshots of the Leisure Suit Larry Reloaded game, which had other problems. We won't go there. But you see the screenshots, and they're just some random people in the background that are obviously Kickstarter backers because yeah. there's no reason to be there except yeah. to be seen. Like he,
and they're all just staring into the camera.
Yeah.
Awkwardly.
Yeah.
But yeah. Actually, another game that I just remembered did it too was The Walking Dead, but it wasn't a Kickstarter thing. It was just, I think if you pre-ordered the season, they had like a random drawing or something to have yourself as a zombie. And I think they had like five people could be zombies and one person was going to be a live person who then got killed to then come back as a zombie to then get killed again. That was like the grand prize. So that character, you know, she fit into the story. It was yeah. the character called Bree, and she, you know, it fit. But then you had, because, I mean, the zombie models weren't, I don't want to say they were generic, like the pirates in Tales of Monkey Island that were obvious, just model swaps. There was a fair bit of diversity in the zombie models, but there was a set limit. So, like, towards the end of the series, you have a couple of episodes where you have all the generic zombies, and then you have, like, two or three zombies that are clearly supposed to look like an actual person that kind of stuck out like a sore thumb.
I honestly didn't notice it.
Yeah, I understood the... Well, I know one of them, if you played the last episode, I'll try and be as spoiler-free as possible for anyone, but there's a scene towards the end where they kind of mimic a scene in the comic and in the TV series where Lee and Clementine have to smear zombie guts all over them,
mm-hmm.
and the zombie that they get the guts from is clearly a Kickstarter backer, or not a Kickstarter backer, a contest winner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a couple
I mean,
of others.
I honestly just didn't notice it.
Yeah, just because he looked completely different.
I would have thought the character was more detailed just because it was the only zombie in the room.
Yeah, well, maybe that too. But yeah, I don't know. It's definitely... It can definitely be hokey if it's not done well.
Mm-hmm.
But that can really be said of anything.
Yeah, I think as long as it's a superficial thing, like, you know, something that can be a throwaway, just, oh, we need a character here. You know, that doesn't really matter.
Actually, I remember a story how years ago, because I always gave, I did this to fan art winners, and there was this one fan art winner who I made his portrait in the game, and I showed it to him, like, hey, here's your character. And the guy was like, he was criticizing it. He's like, my nose isn't that big, my chin, you know, should be a little wider, you know, my cheekbones are higher. And I'm like, dude, come on. Like... And I can only imagine what it would be like if someone paid for the privilege as opposed to, yeah. you know. Like
did he criticize the dialogue?
And the guy was really pissed. Like, he was really, really angry. Like, he was not replying. Like, I emailed him to apologize. He wouldn't reply back. Like, he was so angry with me.
Just can't make people happy.
No.
Just write his dialogue to be really, like, real asshole in the game.
Or just have him voiced by someone like, hi, Rosa, how are you?
Problem solved.
Yep.
We're not passive-aggressive.
Nope.
Make something really, really bad happen to him in the game. So you're like, right, I'm changing this story now.
What? Never mind, I'm not even going to go there.
Sounds like what Homestar from Homestar Runner.
Yeah, I worry in situations like this, like when you have people getting this investment and this input into the game, that stuff like that can happen where people become bitter and, you know, disenchanted with the whole thing, which is stupid, you know, because it's about the game. It's not about, none of that stuff really important on more than a personal
bias. I'm worried about the reliance on Steam Early Access now. That's kind of scaring me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
well, Broken Age is coming out. It's like really just completely incomplete games that just go on there and people can buy it early. Uh-huh. And, you know, it doesn't have to be complete or it doesn't have to have all the features or something. But it's now this big thing that a lot of people are doing now, especially Kickstarter games where they run out of money, so they go on to Early Access and they try to fund the rest of the game that way. But then the problem there, as we've seen already, is that the game is incomplete and has a lot of features missing. So people play it and they're like, it has a lot of features missing. And they talk about that and it just gets a lot of negative buzz that way. No. It's maybe I'm still in the dark ages when it comes to selling games. It's like, you know, I like the whole you pay me money, I give you a thing. That's how I do it. That's very retro,
who,
I guess.
Who does that?
Yeah, seriously. Get with the times, man. Man, I just went out and bought milk. I bought milk today, and I was like, man, give me some milk. And I paid with 3 eggs and a quarter. And the guy was like, I'll give you 1/2 gallon and a sheep. And, you know, that's how you do it.
The barter system. Well, that's what we should go back to.
You move back to the, mm-hmm. yeah, to the dark pages. I think with stuff like games that have, like, Project Zomboid and Minecraft and Starbound, where you can actually play the game and enjoy it, because it's that sort of game, I think that works fine. Obviously, it's not going to work for adventure games unless you're Double Fine and you're going to split your game up, you know. But yeah, it doesn't work for every genre, you know. A very story based world isn't going to feel satisfying on an early access thing, but something that's like a big sandbox, you can still have a lot of fun, I think. So that really, I'd say, depends on genre. Unfortunately,
oh, yeah,
or
Craft fortunate. Was fun, like when it was still in beta. Like, it hadn't even been officially released yet.
Yeah, that's right. And if you've got, like, you know, a real time strategy game, you can still have a multiplayer battle against someone else. Well, that's cool. That's fine. You know, you can play the game. Whereas if the core mechanics of the game are compromised by this, that's when it stops working, I think. So yeah. I don't know. It's very much, man. I look at the things now. You've got Patreon and you've got Kickstarter. Most games you buy before most things, you know, you pay for before you get them these days. It's coming to that point, which is well, I wouldn't say most things.
That's, well, I mean, I've always done pre-order, but when there's like, I mean, that's a little different. I know when the game is coming out, and I'm giving just some incentives to get it early, just to kind of pump up the hype before it comes out.
Yeah, but, and as a consumer, you know you're getting a finished product.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I always say, like, how I think at AdventureX, the first AdventureX in 2012, I gave a presentation about, you know, publishing and business stuff, and like the last point I made was, when you think you've got it all figured out, everything changes. And it's been, you know, a little over a year since then, and everything's changed. So it's I'm always trying to wrap my head around the way things are now, and just, am I doing things right? Am I totally screwing up? You know, and I see a lot of indies talking about going on early access, or you know, trying to get Total Biscuit or PewDiePie to play their game and stuff like that. I'm like, wow, I never even thought about trying to get a player to do it. And that's such a big, that's actually a huge thing now. Like, they say, yeah, you get, they said, yeah, like, you get your sales spikes when you're on a Steam sale, when you get a Retin Up on Rock Paper Shotgun, or you get a prominent Let's Player. I'm like, really? I never thought of that. Yeah. Good luck getting them to play an adventure game. It's really hard.
Well, PewDiePie played Eternally Us, and it got, like 3 million hits or something like that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I haven't even watched the thing. I've avoided it. Not interested. I have a question for you, Dave, about feedback, and for you, Grunderslav. Do you treat other developers, like especially adventure game developers, feedback as more important than just players? Do you think that they can offer more insight, or is everyone equal?
No, I treat it as less important, actually. Like, ah, screw you, you bum.
No. I've noticed.
No, actually, I don't know. It's kind of difficult to treat them as any more or less important. I think it's two different points of view, because it's kind of like how, you know, when you watch a movie and you've studied film or something, you kind of go in and you analyze it from that. It's the same thing as an adventure game developer. You know, you play adventure games now. I play adventure games now and I'm like, oh, well, I guess this is how they did it, or this is how they did it, or whatever. So if you're going in as just a player, that feedback obviously is going to be different, you know, as far as hopefully more like the fun factor, what's difficult, what's not. Whereas you'll get more probably technical things from other adventure game developers. You know, maybe you could code this a little better, or tighten up the graphics on level 3 or stuff like that.
Level 3. You
know. Yeah, that, I'm sorry, that reference goes over your head, Ben. You didn't have that commercial.
Okay. No,
I'll explain later.
Okay. I think...
But Dave,
well, I was talking to a friend the other day about who was just getting into game design, and they were talking about how differently they view games that they play now, because they're a journalist. And they said, now that I've tried to make a game, I realize my point of view has changed. And I think you become both more appreciative of a game and also more critical when you play it after doing it yourself.
Oh, there's a reason why I played many games lately. Except for Telltale, though they're in a league of their own. But the last non adventure game that I played was The Testament of Sherlock Holmes. After I read all these glowing reviews of it, and then I played it, and I couldn't stand it. I just thought it was awful. I was picking apart all the things that I try to avoid. It leapt into with both feet. I mean, things just like. And then
this, you,
when Sherlock is the, when the you, other? When there's a knife and a rope or a cable or something, you need to cut this cable, and the obvious thing would be to use the knife on the rope. He just says, "I can't do that," and I'm like, "What do you mean you can't do that? Like, who, come on! First of all, it's an obvious thing to do, and secondly, it's like that's just give me some kind of response. I mean, come on. Like, this is supposed to be one of the most like highly reviewed adventure games that I've seen in a long time. I mean, it turned out you needed something else to cut the wire with, but still, like, and that was just littered throughout the whole game, and it drove me crazy. And I'm just like, yeah, I couldn't enjoy it the way someone else probably would have, because I'm picking apart all of this crap.
Had you played any of the other games in the Sherlock Holmes series by Frogware?
I played the one with the. I think I played the first one in like 2005, but I don't remember much of it. I remember the dog who was annoying, but I never played any of the others.
Yeah, because they did the Curse or the Silver Earring or something like that, which was a third person game, and then they switched into the first person ones with The Awakened and Nemesis and Jack the Ripper, and then the last one was Testament of Sherlock Holmes, and they're actually coming out with another one this year called Sherlock Holmes Crimes and Punishments or something. But yeah, the funny thing is, if you're not used to those games and you come into them, yeah, it's going to seem awful. But The Testament of Sherlock Holmes is actually the best one so far. Yeah, I mean, they've definitely have not really learned much about interactivity and design. Because, yeah, that's one of the most frustrating things when he's just like, I can't do that. It's like, why? Yeah, exactly. Why not Sherlock? But at least they fixed Creepy Watson. You can ask Janet. We had a laugh about Creepy Watson Sherlock Knight.
Janet fell asleep.
Oh, okay. Well, then don't ask Janet.
Man, this is a thrilling podcast.
Or actually, wake Janet up just to ask her. No, yeah. Don't do that.
I have to say, the one Sherlock Holmes by Frogwares that I've played upset me more on being a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes basis than being a huge fan of adventure games basis.
Oh, so yeah.
I think they did the adventure game thing better than they do the Sherlock Holmes thing. In the one that I've played anyway, the writing was far too clumsy.
Well,
for me.
I loved the old pixel ones. Those were great. Scalpel and the Rose Tattoo. Yeah. Those were both fantastic.
Yeah, I love the Serrated Scalpel. I didn't play the Rose Tattoo. I could never get it to run on my computer, even my old Windows 98 computer. But yeah, the Serrated Scalpel was a lot of fun.
Mm. But I know what you mean, just to go back to what you were saying before, do I take other developers seriously? Oh, yeah. Is yes and no, because usually when another developer critiques my game, it's usually like such high-level stuff that I can't really take any of their criticism or advice on board, because it would just so drastically change the whole thing. Or likewise, when a developer shows me a game for possible publishing, I just have my own ideas of what I like and the types of games that I would want to publish that would work well for my audience, that I just tell them, I said, listen, you know, I could take this, but you're not going to like it very much. And because I have this whole list of things that I think they would need to change. And that's very, you know, corporate of me, but at the same time, it is my sense of my livelihood, and this is how I feel, like, this is how I would do the game. And I just, that's just the way it is. And usually the games I publish, what's funny is that how a lot of the reviewers are surprised, because they say, okay, oh, these games were all made by different, but they all feel like they could be under the same publisher. That's because they were. It's because they're all games that I kind of liked and tweaked them to be kind of something that I would have made myself. So that's sort of the way I do that as a publisher, which not a lot of developers probably would like, sadly.
I think it's important, when you listen to feedback from another developer, to realize that everyone's got their own agenda, their own passion. You know, if you're making games, you're going to become passionate about making games. And if it's in the same genre, you're going to be really picky on what you do like and what you don't like. So if you're listening to another developer giving you criticism about your game, just be aware that they're pushing their own agenda, and we all do it. You know, I know I do.
Oh, I totally am.
Yeah. So, I think that's important to keep in mind, because otherwise, you know, you're going to be looking at, you know, I've talked to developers when they've played like a project of mine in like a beta, and they go, oh yeah, this is good, but you should add this or change this. And you look at it and go, I'm going to have to redesign my whole game if I put that in. No way. I'm not putting that in, you know? So something to keep in mind.
Yeah, because it's a lot easier to just kind of say, oh, yeah, this should be like this. But yeah, if you sit down and think about the work involved in implementing some things. I've had beta testers offer me solutions sometimes for other games where it's like, maybe you should try, you know, instead of this. I can't remember anything offhand. But yeah, it's been stuff where it's like, that would be a really lot of extra work to put into.
I mean, what's funny is that what's sometimes a trivial task and what isn't. It's like, okay, you know, like it'd be really great if the character could, you know, jump here. Like, oh, easy, you know, like just, you know, completely change the laws of physics and gravity. Easy, 2 minutes. But yeah, the character needs to be 1 pixel to the left. Like, you know, I just don't think that's possible. And that sounds funny, but it's so true. Just like, you don't understand like what's going on under the hood. To move that character 1 pixel would require changing so much code. But to do something crazy like changing gravity or whatever is actually could be quite simple.
Player.x minus equals 1.
Yeah.
Semicolon. But yeah, I think a question that I wanted to ask is there a point where you've got like a minor bug in a game, you know, because obviously there are some bugs where you've got a game crashing bug or a design thing where it's a real design flaw and it's a roadblock and a bottleneck and everyone's getting held up by it. But then you've got other stuff that are like minor. Is there a point where you go, look, I need to not care about this, you know, because obviously with a commercial game, you rely on it for your living. You know, you have to release in order to get paid. So where do you get that point where you go, no, I'm going to leave this, I don't care?
Oh, well, towards the end of, if you have like a month left of development before launching, that's when you say that. I think there's a bug that's still in Blackwell Deception where it's more like if it's something that is rare player behavior and doesn't completely break the game, it's just sort of this weird glitch, you just leave it. I mean, there's this thing in Blackwell Deception where you can turn the lights on and off. It was like in the very first location where you can turn the lights on and there's really no reason to turn them off. You can, but typically you wouldn't. But then there's this compartment that you open. And of course it was drawn, the object, you know, for the compartment open was drawn for the lights being on. So if you go and turn the lights off, it'll look weird. And by the, you know, when I'm launching in a month, I'm like, you know what? Screw it. It's going to be very rare that someone's going to do that. And even if they do, it's not going to destroy the game or ruin the experience for them. So I just left it in because I had zero time to get it to work properly.
And just to say the money glows in the dark.
What, Fresco?
Just say the money glows in the dark. Like
the money glows in the dark. Yes.
Oh wait, you haven't seen Pulp Fiction yet. Whoops.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to know, you know, that you can tweak a game forever. You can redo things forever. There's got to be a point where you say, look, this is not perfect. It's time to move on. You know, it's time to release. And releasing a game is really hard when you know this stuff. You go, oh, I could do this better, or this could be slightly done. But when you start looking at everything, the list of changes becomes to the point where you may as well redo. You may as well make a whole different game. You know, you fall into the Duke Nukem Forever trap where they redid the game like 5 times to get it to release, and it still released an average, you know, an average to poor game. Despite 12 years and 5 reworks, you just go, well, what was the point? Why didn't you just release the first thing that you had? You know,
that's why some cases on. Where it's easier to be a publisher than a developer, because as a publisher, I have that distance and be like, okay, no, you do not need to do this. This is what you should focus on. Okay, it's done. Let's do it. And I don't have that, like, that personal investment as an artist or as a writer in something that I'm publishing. It's so I can do that a lot easier. But when, like, Blackwell, for example, like, there's so many little things that I'm noticing that I want to fix, and it's like, oh, people, this will ruin the game. Oh my god, it's crazy. And it's very hard, you know, it's to maintain that distance from something, to just say, okay, like, I gotta stop tweaking this. This is good, you know, it's reached a point where it's good enough, and then you ship it.
Yeah,
like, I was very tempted to get rid of the footprints, because I wasn't sure that they could look right. But you helped me make them look right, so...
We got there.
Yeah.
I think there comes a point where you need, if not yourself, to say it, someone else who's distanced from the project, to go, why are you doing that? Why are you redoing all of this? You know, shouldn't you focus on what's important and then worry about that if you've got time?
Yeah.
You know? And I know I've said that. I know I've said that to people and just said, you know, look, focus on the important stuff. This stuff doesn't matter, you know. It might be something small, you know. It's a cosmetic thing. Make sure you get your... Because it's really easy to work on your game in the first 80% of working on your game, and then that last little bit, you know, we talked about it last time. The last 10% really, really sucks, you know. You have to drag your game kicking and screaming over the finish line, basically. But it's... Yeah, so I think it's important to leave little niggly stuff like that to the very end, and then look at it objectively from that viewpoint and go, now, do I still want to fix this? Is it still important enough to me to want to fix it now that everything else is done?
I think I might have... today, I remember you sent me a background, and there's a mirror in the background. It's like the last room in the game that you've done. I'm like, you know, this is a very tiny mirror, and this is only one small scene in the game that you're barely in for any length of time. And it's like, hey, what are the chances of being able to make that mirror reflect the character? And, you know, like, you know what? It's probably not worth it to do that at this point. That's probably too much work. And then you were just like, yeah, I'll just add that to the list, shall I?
What's on the list?
It's somewhere at the bottom.
Yeah, it'll get done eventually.
It takes 2 seconds. I've got reflection code in my game that Ben wrote.
Yeah. But that reflection code for
a 4-direction character, and this is an 8-direction character.
Yeah, we got diagonal wall loops. So yeah, it's important to know, you know, this is a nice thing. It would be nice to have. It's a fun feature, but
it's not a deal. It's not going to break the game.
It's not going to break the game. It's not going to add really anything to the game. It's just something, a little nice extra touch to have if we've got time, I think. Yeah. And if it doesn't break anything, that's another thing too. If you get to the very end of the game, I know you've talked about, like, guys that you've published that want to add features right up to the 11th hour, and you've had say, no, not doing it, you'll add bugs, don't do it.
You know, sure,
which
enough,
I agree with completely. And that's really hard to do, because you have this great idea and it'll be fun to implement, and you go, oh man, this will add so much to the game, but half of the stuff they're adding to the game is, you know, another month of testing, another week worth of bug fixing. That's not worth it.
Yeah, or you think it's easy. You think it's just one small change, just one line of code. But inevitably, like, and this has happened, like, you know, a change to the closing credits can break the first scene of the game. And that has happened. I'm not making that up.
Oh, what are you doing? Oh, man. But yeah, I think you have to become not dispassionate, but you have to become a little bit cold towards your own project, a little bit numb, and just go... You know,
like I said, that's when publishing something makes it a little easier. Because
I'm
curious about something.
So that is what you guys have to look forward to.
I'm Yeah, actually, speaking of that, I'm curious, what would you say as a publisher, what would you say has been either the most, not difficult, but what would you say has been, like, out of the games you've published, the one thing that you've gone in and been like, okay, no, look, we really need to change this, and that's been kind of a major thing?
We changed the ending of Resonance. And he was actually surprisingly, he was upset about it at first, but he was surprisingly cool about it, thought about it. There was this, it was one of these things where there was just, the ending hinged upon a lot of things happening in the background that the player never saw. And it was kind of getting to the 11th hour, and I got to the end of the game, and I just could not follow. I just didn't understand anything. I'm like, wait, so what happened? This happened when? What? And I just didn't understand it all. And I was kind of upset because it had been leading up to this big revelation, and it was all about stuff that was deliberately hidden from you the entire time. And Janet and I sat down and we worked out just a different backstory that fit what you had actually seen. And it made it a lot more sad. The end made the ending a lot more satisfying. We just changed the dialogue of the ending, and we didn't have to change the rest of the game at all. And we listed our reasoning and our changes to Vince, and we're like, "Yes, we know we're being kind of executive right now, but out." And it's one of those things that had been in for so long, and I totally get this. When something's in your head for so long, it makes complete sense to you. But yeah, it might not be, it's hard to get that out when it's so in your head. So we helped him do that. He was much for it, and he'd agree that it's much better for it. But I'd say that was probably one of the more difficult things we had to do as publishers, because, you know, you don't want to be the guy. Totally, we're that guy. Let's just make some of these changes here. And, you know, we to minimize the damage, so the actual game at the very end was completely untouched. Everything was completely untouched. The only thing that we had to change was the dialogue at the very, very end, which we tweaked to so meshed more with what the player actually experienced during the game as opposed to stuff they didn't. So yeah, that was probably the most difficult thing we had to do.
Yeah, I mean, Resonance was in development for a really long time, and it's easy to lose sight of things.
Vince, I know you listen to this stuff, so, you know.
Yeah, that's right, he does.
Hi, Vince. Hello, Vince.
Hi, Vince. But yeah, I know it's easy to lose sight of certain things when you're working on something for so long. And like you say, yeah, if it makes perfect sense in your head, but you've been working on it for so long, sometimes you just kind of take for granted that other people will understand it. So,
yeah. Like, there was this plot hole in Blackwell that I thought was huge. I thought was such a big deal. and then I mentioned it to you, Francisco, and you're like, oh, like, I didn't even know. Like, no one seemed to notice it. It's like in Deception how Madeline says that she was, you know, banished to the void by her host. But then in the previous game, it was established that all this happened because the link was transferred from one person to another. And I realized after the game came out that, oh my god, I totally contradicted the plot of the first game, and no one seemed to notice. And I'm like, how come no one noticed this? And you just said, oh, well, yeah, I just assumed that it didn't work and they had to try something else. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense. So let's go with that.
I think we were talking about, like, giving feedback before and how it can be hard to say, oh, you know, we're going to have to change this or something like that. I think it's really important. I won't give feedback about something to someone unless I truly believe that I'm making a point that I feel is important, you know, and I make sure that if I give a bit of feedback, you know, I own it completely. You don't go, oh, I guess you could sort of kind of change this, you know. And you can ask Grundeslev, you know, if I give feedback to him, I'm straight up about it. You know, I don't beat around the bush and go, I guess you could kind of probably do this different if you want. If I think something's looked bad, I'll say straight away, you know, this looks bad, that looks wrong. You know, and it's not that I'm trying to be rude and say, you know, you're wrong, this looks wrong. It's just that it's important, if you're giving feedback, to own that feedback completely. There's no point saying something if you don't believe in it fully. You know, because if you don't believe in it, how is the other person supposed to believe in it? So I think if you are giving feedback, or like in your case, being a publisher saying, you know, you're not just saying the things you're saying because you go, oh, this is my opinion, you know. You've actually got a valid reason for saying something. And it can be hard when you're the person receiving that feedback to go, oh man, you know, this is a really valid point, and not just go, oh, this person is just being rude or just pushing their agenda. Sometimes yeah, it's important we really to step like back.
Again, Vince, I know, since I know you're listening, we felt when we were sitting down and talking about it, we just kept thinking, yeah, Vince is going to kill us. Vince is going to kill us. And you are surprisingly cool about it, so thank you.
Yeah, I think the biggest disservice that you can do to someone is to sugarcoat your feedback. Because, yeah, like you say, I mean, you don't need to be a jerk about giving feedback if you just give constructive, honest criticism. That's invaluable because, I mean, like we were saying about advice or ideas from other developers. I mean, Ben is a fellow developer, and I take his opinion highly when it comes to art now because, you know, we've both, I mean, Ben is a talented artist, and he obviously has learned a lot, and he has a lot of wisdom to share. So, you know, when I do a background and I show it to him, and he says to me, oh, good. You know, a lot of people, if you showed your background, if you do a background, you're really proud of it, and you put a lot of time into it, and you showed it to somebody, and they just went, oh, good. A lot of people would be like, what, that's it? What? But it's not like that, I mean, as far as with Ben, because I know, you know, Ben saying, oh, good, is the equivalent of anyone else saying, that's absolutely fantastic. Because, you know, it's a different bar, it's a different standard. Whereas if he says, what's wrong with you? You know, what happened to your perspective? What's going on? Come on, you know? I'm not heartbroken about it because I know it's true, and I know that I have to go back and tweak stuff. Whereas, So, you know, if someone sends you something, and, you know, you say, oh, this is great, this is fantastic, yeah, great. I'm not saying you shouldn't say that because, you know, it's nice to show appreciation. But, you know, if you'd say that consistently, then you're not really doing them a service, you know, if there's something that you find that really needs tweaking. So,
yeah, I think it's important. Like, it's really nice to be nice to someone and go, oh, man, this looks amazing, and encourage them or something like that. But that's not helpful if it doesn't look amazing. You know, that doesn't help at all. It reminds me of a story where some kid used to show his grandma, you know, a picture that he'd draw, and his grandma every single time would go, oh, man, that's the best thing ever. So one day he was like, man, my grandma says this every time. So he drew, like, the worst thing he could possibly draw and went and showed his grandma. And she said, oh, man, that's amazing. He said, well, obviously she's just saying it. She doesn't think I'm good at drawing at all, you know. So if you, like, being
and it
a
turned out that grandma was blind.
That's an awful twist. What an awful person. but yeah, it's important. Like, being complimenting a person on their skill is nice, but that lasts for 2 seconds. That, who cares, you know? It does them more service to say, to point out things that you notice that don't feel good, you know. If I show somebody a picture and they say, oh, wow, that looks great, I go, okay, who cares, you know.
I think it was the worst.
I'm just going to leave the podcast that I'm falling asleep.
Bye, Jenna. Okay.
Bye, sorry.
She's okay. Poor Jan. The Wi-Fi is a little shaky, so the cable, I had to connect to the cable, which is in the bedroom. And
okay.
We'll
be done soon.
I think it was Scott Straub. What is his name? The PDP Online, the webcomic artist. Scott Straub, I forget his name. Scott Kurtz, that's his name. In one of his blogs, he wrote about how he, you know, did this cartoon and showed it to his dad. And his dad said, you know, he's like, yeah. He's like, so do you want to be a professional? He's like, yes, I do. He's like, how long did this take you to draw it? It's like, it took me an hour. Well, if you want to be a professional, you have to be able to draw that in like 5 minutes. And because it was a cartoon, he's like, you can't, you know, if you're doing, you know, cartooning for a strip, you can't take 2 hours to draw like one little thing. So he that's what he did. He kept practicing until he could do it. He could do like those he could draw those characters in 5 minutes. And then like years and years later, he told his dad that story, and his father didn't remember. He like, burst into tears. He's like, really? So I always thought that was a nice story.
Yeah. That's a very good point as well, because, you know, I say to a lot of people, if they show me art and they go, oh, you know, I spent 3 days working on this background and it's half done and I'm really proud of it and I think I've got a great style, and I'll always say to them, I said, look, it's looking great, but you cannot spend, you know, a week on a single background if you're also doing the programming, the design, and the animation. You know, it's fine if you're just doing the backgrounds, but if this is the speed you're working at, you really have to either speed up or find someone else to work on the other parts of the game. It's important.
Simplify your style.
Yeah, it's important to give like practical advice to people that doesn't, you know, that doesn't lead them astray, but does remind them of the big picture of, you know, especially like I look at me and I like how many scenes you might have to draw for a single game when you're working on a full length game. I think I just did the 68th one for Blackwell.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, that's the last one.
Yeah, and if you did 68 scenes and they all took you a week and you only had a year to make the game, it's not going to work. It's just, it's simply not going to happen, you know? So it's important to give feedback that's of a practical advice like that, you know? It really highlights the issue there is, you know, I look at concept artists. There's a school of design on YouTube, FZD, I think it is. It's a very popular show, and this guy makes 4 amazing pieces of art a day if he's working on a contract, and you go, well, you know, I mean, he's top-tier professional. He's one of the best, but you look at that and you go, oh, man, you know, if ever I think I'm fast at drawing, I just look at his stuff and just go, no, I'm not. I got to speed up. If you want to do this over a long-term
thing. Spend more time on this Black Hole game than I've spent on anything I've ever done.
Yeah, so it's important to look at things from a practical point of view when giving advice. I think that's a really good point that you made with the webcomic there. That really matters, you know. Yeah. Especially in commercial games where that's your one income.
Yeah. I mean, I know I did have a baby last year, but I guess like it's been a little over a year of full-time work on this, and I guess, you know, in terms of game standards, that actually isn't bad, really. I mean, for the the game, I mean, you know the game more than anyone, Ben. It's pretty damn big, and
yeah, for a Blackwell game, especially, you know, for when you, because I played all the games before starting on this, and I played them all in like one weekend, and I think Epiphany itself takes me, you know, knowing all the puzzles off by heart because I've played it over and over and over again. Even that takes a fair while to play through, so yeah, it's a pretty big game.
I mean, it took me, when I did a speed through of it the other day, and that took me like 4 hours, so...
Oh my god.
It's a long game, which is why it's taking so long, but...
I haven't done a speed through. I actually just finished it today, but I haven't done a speed through of it, but last time I did, it took me like an hour, and I was like, oh my god, this game is not going to take any time at all.
Well, I mean,
that's a subject for another day.
I mean, even, I remember not too long ago, I replayed, I think it might have been... I don't remember. God damn, what game was it? It was an old LucasArts game. I think it might have been Loom. And it took me no time because I played it, I was exploring, I was trying to solve some of the puzzles. But then when I played it again, knowing everything, it took me, takes no time at all.
Sure. Most of the old adventure games, you can play through them in one sitting. I think I've done Curse of Monkey Island in like 7 hours in one sitting.
I mean, what's funny is that I remember Resonance took me speed throughing it and knowing all the most efficient way to get through the game just to see if I could do the primary path. When I was testing that would take me 4 hours to do. And so I thought, wow, this is a long game. But then
skipping,
I get emails
all the dialogue
from people saying, why is this game so short? It took me 2 hours. I'm like, no, it didn't. There's no way. Like me, who is like no, like who... like skips all the dialogue, knows the most efficient way to, you know, knows like to go here before here to collect that item to use here, like, and that took me 4 hours. There is no way it took anyone else 2 hours. I am sorry, unless you played it like with a walkthrough and you had a time machine. There is just no way.
You'd be surprised. Time machine becomes a qualifier after the walkthrough.
Well, you'd be surprised at what length some people will go through.
But yeah, I think people give unrealistic feedback. Like, because if a game really immerses you, the time will fly. You know, so what a personal opinion might be on how long a game is. You know, when I know how much I play certain games, then you look at them now with like Steam or a lot of consoles will remember how much, you know, how much you play the game for. I look and I go, oh man, did I really waste that much time on that game? Well,
yeah, but Steam isn't always accurate, because Steam Steam says that I've played Grand Theft Auto 4 for about 400 hours, but I think that's because it counts the time that the Rockstar Social Club launcher is open and not the actual game itself. So I've probably only played like maybe 5 hours.
This is one reason why I hated the like the Xbox achievement points. What are they called?
Achievement points.
They weren't achievement points. They were called something else.
Oh, gamer score.
The gamer score, yeah.
Yeah.
And PlayStation 3 has something similar, but I hated seeing that number go up. Because like I had a high number, and it's like, God damn it. Like, I don't want a high number. I don't want a reminder of how much time I spend on this stuff.
I do. So,
I know I got to the end of Kingdoms 100% of Amalur Reckoning, and it was like 81 hours or something like that, and I just looked at it and just went, that's a long time.
Yeah, same really thing happened to me with Ni No Kuni. I finished it, and it was like, I finished the main story, and it was like 60 something hours, and then it was like, here's all this new game plus after the main story stuff you can do, and I was just like, oh god.
Bad.
Yeah. That's one of the few games I never finished.
Yeah.
Did you?
There's actually like a whole elaborate Pokemon like training system that you have to get every single creature and train them to maximum to get like a trophy. So for a trophy whore like me, that's a bit daunting.
I mean, the funny thing about that, Janet always joking, she was watching me play it. She's like, wow, like, so you eat cheeseburgers and milkshakes and coffee like to restore your health. Like, and this is a kid's game. What kind of message is this sending?
What game is this, like game dev story?
Ni No Kuni.
No, I was joking about game developer diets.
He's on the game developer diet.
Yeah, well, he really is. But yeah, it's funny how much time you can put into a game. Man, I remember Civilization 2, like waking up early on a Sunday morning, and like my brother and I would put it in and play a hot seat, and look up from the game, and it was like sundown, you know, and we'd woken up early to start playing it. Time can fly.
Yeah, you know. Like in The Sims, but we won't get into that.
We won't get into The Sims.
But anyway, speaking of time flying, I think it's probably about time we wrapped up this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at the time.
Look at the time. Sorry.
Yes. I guess the mandatory self-promotion. Follow me at Grindislav Games on Twitter, if you don't already.
Oh, I'm at Wajedai Games. That's WADJET.
Yeah, and I have a Twitter account, but I think you can follow me in more interesting ways, you know, in an unmarked vehicle or something like that. That'd be more exciting. And if you'd like to leave feedback on our podcast, please make sure you take the advice that we gave on giving feedback during this podcast into account when giving the feedback on the podcast.
Yes, and you can leave feedback for our podcast by following on Twitter at @BCT_podcast. And
wait, this podcast has a Twitter account?
Yes, it does.
I did not know that.
Well, now you do. You can follow it.
All right.
And pretty much you'll just get updates on when new episodes are released.
Okay.
Because that's all we ever tweet about.
But well, yeah, I don't have access to the account. Oh,
yeah, you do. I told you the password.
BCT podcast?
Yeah, BCT _ podcast.
You are now followed by me.
Ooh.
Oh, man.
Creepy.
Just wait until anyway. I remember the password and get on there.
Crocodile Dundee.
You haven't seen our logo. Well, that's good. Oh, yeah, there's also a shrimp on a Barbie.
Shrimp on the Barbie.
Crocodile Dundee in your. Oh, I guess Australia. I guess I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, and if you have any suggestions for topics that you want us to talk about, you can tweet us, us like we did today. And then you can go look at our funny logo.
Amusing. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's fine.
And a Barbie doll and a wrench. Okay, yeah, sorry. Y'all can see this for yourself if you go to the Twitter.
Yeah, it's wrenches because it's tools in a blue cup.
Ah.
And there's a shrimp on the Barbie. So.
Shrimp on the Barbie.
And Barbie.
Do you know a funny thing about the shrimp on the Barbie pun?
Shrimp on a Barbie.
Yeah,
I get it.
Do you know what's funny about that? Is that I put the Barbie in the image and the shrimp in the image. Like, I did not mean to make that pun. And then when I looked at it and went, oh, man, I'm an accidental genius.
Why did you put a Barbie in if you weren't intending on putting...
Because Barbies are Australian.
They are?
No, barbecues. Oh, like, yeah. Everybody calls them a Barbie over here, so I was like,
"Well, no, I know that." But you weren't intending to make the pun, why did you put a Barbie and a shrimp?
And a shrimp.
Because I thought it would be a funny hat, and then I looked at it and went, "Oh man, that actually works really well."
Remember what we were saying earlier about how some people find the little minutiae and others can't see the character walking backwards? I think we've just found a perfect example of that.
Oh dear.
And on that note, thanks for listening to the podcast. And well, Dave, thank you for being on our podcast again.
Oh, it was great fun.
And we'll see you all next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.